Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Chris Wallace is a veteran journalist and anchor of Fox News Sunday. His new book, Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the 116 Days That Changed the World, is a behind-the-scenes account of the secret meetings and events across the globe during the 116 days leading up to the world's first use of the atomic bomb in wartime, the American attack on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. This August marks the 75th anniversary of the bombing. Throughout his 50 years plus in broadcasting, Chris Wallace has won every major broadcast news award for his reporting, including three Emmy Awards and the Peabody. He is currently the anchor of Fox News Sunday. And again, the name of the new book is Countdown 1945. And we welcome Chris Wallace to The Book Show. What a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Joe. I appreciate it.
It's hard to believe that you've been doing this as long as you have, and this is your first book.
Well, you know, it's interesting. A lot of my colleagues write memoirs, and I've always thought that was a terrible idea because in the end, we don't do anything. We report on things. We're a tremendous eyewitness to history, but it's not our history. It's somebody else's. And so I had no interest in doing that. Over the years, I'd come up with the idea that I wanted to do something. And it's funny because my favorite review captured exactly what it was I wanted to do. So the Washington Post wrote, "I know what happened in 1945, but this book reads like a thriller." And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to do a thriller because, you know, so many of these sort of big, dusty historical tomes, they assume everybody knows sort of what happened and its analysis of how it happened, why it happened. But to me, the excitement of history is that at the moment that these huge decisions were being made, the people making them didn't know. So that's what I wanted to do, is transmit the sense of urgency, the sense of uncertainty, and the enormity of what it was they were going through as they were going through it.
So tell us how, when in starting this process, that it actually came out of a meeting at Nancy Pelosi's office.
Yeah, this is a funny story. So, I had this idea, the history thriller, but I didn't have the topic. And in February of 2019, the day that President Trump was going to deliver that year's State of the Union speech, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, invited about a half dozen TV anchors to a hideaway on the House side of the Capitol for what's called a pre-buttal. It's a funny thing, only in Washington. And both parties do it. If they're from opposite parties, if there's a Republican president, as in this case, and a Democratic speaker, the Democratic speaker invites reporters and gives a pre-buttal, which is basically saying everything that's wrong with the president's State of the Union speech before he's even given it. We were in this room called the Board of Education, and Nancy Pelosi, she's telling us about the room. She says it was in this room that Harry Truman got the call to go to the White House. He didn't know it at the time, but it was because Franklin D. Roosevelt had just died. And Truman, the call he gets is just get to the White House as quickly and quietly as possible. And Truman hangs up the phone, Pelosi telling us the story, and he says, "Jesus Christ and General Jackson." And I suddenly thought to myself, I got it. That is what I'm going to do my book on, and I'm going to take, and I didn't know then it was 116 days, but it turned out it was, between April 12, 1945, when Truman discovers that he's been vice president for 82 days, he's now the new president because Roosevelt has died, and 116 days later when the U.S. drops the bomb on Hiroshima.
That is what is so fascinating about Truman's input here, because he inherits this. And what we learn in the book, and what of course happened, is that this project had been going on for years, was well in motion and ready to go. And as you write in the book, Truman really, he didn't even talk to Roosevelt that much prior and knew nothing of any of this.
You know, that's the great joy when you get some amazing fact that you wouldn't have dreamt if you were a Hollywood screenwriter. But, you know, as a lot of people say, truth is stranger than fiction. And you suddenly find out that this is true. And what it is that he goes to the White House and Eleanor Roosevelt says, "Harry, the president's dead." And about an hour later, he's sworn in as president. as I say, only been vice president for 82 days and had only met privately with Roosevelt twice as vice president in those 3 months. So now the Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, says, "Mr. President, I got to take you aside." And he gets in the room with him and he says, "I need to tell you about an immense top secret project to develop the most powerful weapon in history." Truman knows nothing about the Manhattan Project. And then that's all Stimson says, because I know you, he says, "I know you've been so overwhelmed by everything that's happened today. I'm going to wait a little bit until you've settled in, and then I'll tell you." So it was actually 13 days later, on April 25th, when Stimson comes back with General Leslie Groves, who was the military director of the Manhattan Project, and they brief Truman for the first time about the atom bomb. Oppenheimer, who was the scientific director and the real scientific brains behind the Manhattan Project, says, "You know, Roosevelt was a great architect. Let's hope that Truman is a good carpenter."
You also get the sense very much that Truman is true to this project, and even later in his life in defending it.
You know, he owned the decision from April on, and as I say in the book, it's 116 days from when he takes over till they drop the bomb. So he had to make the final decision right, whether or not to drop it. And, you know, one of the things that I guess I didn't fully realize until I started researching the book, Truman's decision is not drop the bomb or do nothing, because they're in a bloody war, the U.S. is, with Japan. And in fact, as they get closer to the Japanese homeland, the Japanese are resisting and fighting even more fiercely and causing an enormous number of U.S. casualties. So the choice for Truman was drop the bomb or invade the homeland. And the projections he got from Truman did from his military advisors, civilian and military, was if you invade Japan, that we're now talking the summer of 45, the war will go on until the end of 46, at least another year and a half. And the projections were there would be 1 million Japanese casualties and 500,000 American casualties. So, in fact, the spilling of blood, American but also Japanese, was going to be even greater invading than dropping the bomb. So I think that he was comfortable. It wasn't just that Roosevelt had done it and he was following in his footsteps. He was comfortable with the decision he made, and as you might expect, he was asked about it for the rest of his life, in the rest of his presidency and then in retirement, and he never backed off it. He said, "Look, it was a tough decision, but it was a way to end the war, and I'd do it again."
One of the things that I found interesting, the two individuals in particular, and I'm assuming, I don't know this, I'm assuming that this goes into the category of some of the great highs, but you write of the main players, of course. You write of Truman, you write of Oppenheimer, you write of Tibbetts, you write of so many people who were major players in this and their perspective. You also write about Ruth Sisson, and you write about Hideko Tamura Snyder. Give us a sense of those two individuals and what it was like to follow their stories and to weave it into this narrative.
This book checks so many boxes, just as a dramatic thriller, as a must read, because there was the political aspect, there was the scientific aspect, there was the military aspect, but there was also the human aspect. And you know, I thought, you've got to tell the story in terms of the home front. And especially, as I say, one of the big issues was, if you don't drop the bomb, you're going to have to invade. And if you invade, that means that a lot of people, our lives are going to be at risk. This is what Truman's thinking about. He ended up saying, "I think the flower of American youth was worth a couple of Japanese cities." So we're looking around for people on the home front. And through social media websites, we find not only was there this woman, Ruth Sisson, who had been involved at Oak Ridge in the enrichment of uranium, but that she's still alive. And as you say, this is 75 years ago. She was 19 then. She's in her 90s now. And she was a perfect, embodiment of exactly what I wanted, part of the story I wanted to tell, because she signs up to work at Oak Ridge on a project, and she really knows nothing, and all of the people, as to what they're doing. They're just told that this is an important part of the war effort. And it turns out that she's one of the so-called Calitron girls. And the Calitrons were these enormous machines with all of these dials and knobs and stuff. And all they were told was just keep the meter in the green. Don't let it go over into the red. And they had to fiddle with the dials. What she didn't know was that they were enriching uranium, that she was enriching the U-235 and the plutonium that ended up fueling the atom bombs. And what made her story especially dramatic was the fact that she had a boyfriend, later her husband, after the war, named Lawrence Huddleston, who'd been an army medic in the European theater and had seen terrible fighting and had survived the fighting. And she thrilled on May 8th when the war in Europe ends, the Nazis surrender. But then she's immediately terrified that he's going to be set over to a more immediate conflict in the Pacific. And what she doesn't know is that in these Calitron machines, she's creating the fuel that may save his life by creating, you know, being the wherewithal for the bomb. Hideko Tamura was an even more dramatic story. You clearly couldn't tell the story of the dropping of the bomb without telling the human story of the people who were going to be the victims, the people at Ground Zero. Hideko Tamura was a 10-year-old girl who lived with a very wealthy family in Hiroshima. And she was sent out to the countryside. Hiroshima had not been bombed at all, but her, obviously a lot of other cities had, and her parents sent her out to the countryside to what supposedly was going to be this school so that she could avoid any bombing. Well, she hated it. It really was not a school. It was a work camp, and they had to carry heavy rocks around and dig out roots and stuff. And so she smuggled a letter to her mother saying, please come rescue me. Bring me home. Again, she's only 10 years old. Her mother comes, finds her, says, you know, let's spend the night. I just came out on the train. It was about 65 miles outside Hiroshima, and, you know, let's spend a few days in the countryside. And Hideko says to her mother, she was a very willful girl, no, I want to go home tomorrow. So they spend the night, they go home the next day. The next day, that day, is August 5th. So they're back in Hiroshima at Ground Zero on August 6th when the bomb is dropped. And she is also alive and is now a woman in her 80s.
The name of the book is Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the Atomic Bomb and the 116 Days That Changed the World. 116 days, of course, as you mentioned, is from the time that Truman took office to the time that the bomb was dropped. One of the things that I found so surprising was this project had been in the works for years. Really, up until the last 3-4 weeks, there was so much that was major that had not been decided. A, did it work? Did it actually work? Also, where it was going to drop, how it was going to be used, if it was going to be used. All really big questions that went down to the wire.
Yeah, it again, as I say, you know, as you research it, you find these amazing details. And July 16th may be my favorite day in this whole story.
Yeah.
Truman wakes up on July 16th. He's in Potsdam, Germany, for a summit with Winston Churchill, the prime minister of Great Britain, and Joseph Stalin, the premier of Russia. And, you know, Roosevelt had been part of those conferences in Tehran and Yalta. Now Roosevelt is dead, and Truman is going to be part of the new big three. And he's honestly quite insecure about it because he's never been on the world stage. And now suddenly he's going to be a major player with these two men who had quite good and working and long working relationships with Roosevelt, but don't know Truman from Adam. So in any case, that same day, while he's waking up and getting ready for the Potsdam conference, in Alamogordo, New Mexico, 8 time zones away, they're about to test the atom bomb, the gadget, as they called it, for the first time. And you're quite right, Joe. To Truman, the atom bomb in the Manhattan Project was a science project until they knew whether it would actually work. So as they're about to do it at 5:30 in the morning in New Mexico, the various very noted scientists are there like March Madness wagering, like a pool. Is this going to be a dud? Is it going to be kind of like a conventional explosive? Is it going to be a super weapon that is going to ignite the atmosphere? And if so, how much of America is it going to take out? They had no idea, really, as to what its impact would be. Well, it goes off. It's enormously powerful, but in a manageable way. And late that night, because it's 8 hours difference, in Potsdam, Germany, about 8, 9 o'clock at night, Truman gets word the bomb works. You know, this isn't a science project. It's a super weapon. And now he suddenly realizes, well, I may be the junior partner in terms of tenure, but I'm the senior partner in terms of clout because I now have the most powerful weapon in the world.
Just 4 days later, you write in the book, 17 days from the time that the bomb has dropped, you write, Truman's mood had gotten even worse as the conference spent days accomplishing almost nothing. The long-winded Churchill continued to ramble on, while Stalin was terse and blunt in refusing to give his allies any concessions. Truman was, quote, sick of the whole business. He wrote to Bess, I have to make it perfectly plain to them at least once a day that so far as this president is concerned, Santa Claus is dead and my first interest is USA. Then I want the Jap War won and I want them both in it. He was getting restless.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the interesting things about Truman is, yes, he was new. He's been called the accidental president. He really had been ignored by Roosevelt. But he was an experienced politician, if on a much lower level. He had been a county commissioner in western Missouri, and then he had been a senator for 10 years. Now he's vice president. Now he's president. And he, one of the things that became clear within 2 weeks after he became president, he liked to make decisions. When they would have cabinet meetings, Roosevelt would kind of regale the cabinet with long sort of personal anecdotes and not get much done. Truman was decisive. I mean, his cabinet meetings went like clockwork. So now he's in this international summit. And exactly as I say there, Churchill is just sort of prattling on and is very much a diminished figure as the British Empire is a diminished force in the world. And Stalin is given nothing up. I mean, he has marched from the east, from Russia. He's taken over much of Eastern Europe. And in the Yalta Conference, they had agreed that they would create democratic governments in a lot of these places. And Stalin is not agreeing to any of that. He's taken over much of Eastern Europe, and he's going to keep it, either directly or through puppet governments there. So he is enormously frustrated. And meanwhile, the main subject on Truman's mind is, how do I end this war? And he's still, even now that he knows that it works, he is still torn between, on the one hand, dropping the bomb, which he knows is going to cause a tremendous loss of life, or going ahead with what really was plan A at that point, which was the invasion. But he knows that that is going to be bloody, continue the war for another year and a half, and cause hundreds of thousands of casualties, maybe a million casualties. And one of the things that's going on in his mind is, look, if I don't use the bomb and we have this terribly bloody invasion, and years from now or maybe months from now, people find out Truman had this weapon at his disposal that Roosevelt had approved in 1942, and he didn't use it, and as a result, tens or hundreds of thousands of Americans died, how will he be judged by history? So he had a lot on his mind.
A couple of things I want to get to before we end, and that is your writing about the flight crew. I was fascinated by Robert Lewis. Robert Lewis, perhaps the captain best known for writing in his log, My God, What Have We Done? There's been some question as to what exactly was meant by that. But he comes off as a figure that it's sometimes hard to sympathize with.
Yeah. Well, the 509th Composite Group, which was this special unit that was created to deliver the first atom bomb absolutely top secret. And the head of it, the commander, is Colonel Paul Tibbetts. And he was the person in charge. He assembled all of the, and it was a very sizable unit. There were pilots, there were bombardiers, there were navigators, there were gunners, there were support ground crews. They just for the mission itself to drop the bomb, they needed seven planes. Only one was going to drop the bomb, but there were a number that were there to check the weather, to check whether there were Japanese planes about, to do the measurements and the filming of the explosion. It was a real operation. So there were two. I mean, one of the things that also makes this such a good story is that, you know, as you might expect, having seen Top Gun or a lot of movies about flight crews, they were hot shots. They all thought, I'm the best pilot or bombardier, whatever, in the Army Air Corps, and I should be on the final mission. Well, nobody had a higher sense of himself than Robert Lewis, who was one of the pilots. And in fact, he and Tibbetts were at the time considered kind of the Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams of bombing pilots. And, you know, you could argue who was better than the other. Well, Tibbetts was the boss. And at one point he says to Lewis, Robert, you're going to be on the mission. And Lewis just assumes, well, that means he's going to be the pilot. He's going to be the commander of the mission. Well, no, Colonel Tibbetts, who was in charge of assigning the crew, he decided he was going to be in charge of the mission. And when Lewis finds out that he's going to be in the second seat, he's going to be the co-pilot, he was absolutely furious.
And as you're right, even years later, he was still bitter about that. Since we're running out of time, I do also want to ask you, because you just touched on it, about the media role here. And as a journalist, I'm interested in your perspective on this. You write a lot about William Lawrence, who had this story of a lifetime. He was a New York Times reporter who was embedded from almost the beginning in the Manhattan Project and watching this whole thing unfold, and was even a part of one of the missions. That in and of itself is amazing, and yet did come under some controversy as to of just how independent he could be in his thinking. I'm interested in what you think about that, but also in just the overall umbrella of how, and this is something that I was really fascinated by in the book, by how everyone in the government and that was planning this project was keenly aware of its importance, obviously. And they wanted to tell the story, from the hiring of Lawrence to the photo shoots to the calling the media. This was something they wanted documented.
Yeah, well, no, this was a fascinating story to me. And again, something I knew nothing about when I started on this project. So in April of 45, actually, it's pretty late, General Groves, who was the military and the overall commander of the Manhattan Project, walks into the New York Times and goes to meet the editor, and he says, I've got a great story. I can't tell you what it is. I've got a great story, and I would like William Lawrence, who was a very distinguished science reporter for the Times that had won a Pulitzer Prize in the late 30s, I would like him detached from the Times, and exactly, you know, it's not a phrase he used, but it's what we now have come to know as being embedded. He's going to be inside, but he's going to disappear. And he's not going to be filing for you, and he's not going to be able to tell the story that he's going to have exclusive access to until we tell him he can. So the editor is somewhat, you know, concerned. It's a kind of an odd, you know, I guess unprecedented request, but he says yes. And then they bring in Lawrence, and Lawrence says yes with one caveat, and that is, I want complete access. In other words, if you're going to have me inside, I want to really know what's happening. And Grove says yes. So for the last 4 months, he's inside the Manhattan Project. He's with the scientists. Goes to Tinian Island, which is the launch pad for the missions, with the flight crews. And he gets the whole story. But the condition on it is, from the government's point of view, you can write it yourself, but it can't be published until we tell you. And in fact, he's there for the first mission, but not able to go along on it, Hiroshima. And then 3 days later, when the Japanese refused to surrender, he's actually on board the plane called the Boxcar that drops the second bomb on Nagasaki. And then all of the stories come out, and they are just fascinating and so brilliantly written. And he wins a Pulitzer Prize for that coverage. Incidentally, to give you a sense of how different things are, in the 2000s, a group of reporters come back to the Times. Lawrence has passed away by this point, and they say, look, he was really working for the government. He was actually on the government payroll. He was also writing press releases. He should give up his Pulitzer Prize, or the Times should. And the Times says, no, we're keeping it. It was a great job, and we're not giving it back. But the other point, which is, after the bomb is dropped, the government goes into a very sophisticated public relations campaign. And there were two parts to it. The first part was what they told, which was the Pentagon put out a bunch of stories about the sort of the brilliance and the tremendous organization and the enormous national effort that went into the Manhattan Project. The flip side of it was what they didn't tell. And they had strict censors as part of the occupation of Japan. A Japanese film crew goes to Hiroshima, 32-man crew, and films the devastation. And as soon as they get out of Hiroshima and get back to Tokyo, the American military occupiers confiscate the film. And they refuse to tell the story of what had happened on the ground. And really, most people didn't find it out until a New Yorker reporter named John Hersey, who snuck into Hiroshima and comes out in it a year later, in August of 1946, writes what becomes a huge best-selling book, but at first was a magazine article, Hiroshima, in which he spent a long period of time on the ground in Hiroshima and details the horror of what happened on the ground there.
Chris Wallace's new book is Countdown 1945, The Extraordinary Story of the 116 Days That Changed the World. It is published by Avid Reader Press with Simon & Schuster. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.